What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off.
Braden Anderson is an attorney at Kirkland & Ellis, and he is the author of a brand new book called Black Resilience. In this conversation, we talk about a lot, everything from crypto regulation, legal frameworks, and then we talk about his background, many of the different difficult situations that he's navigated, including how he almost made it to the NBA and the different setbacks that made him go on a different path and eventually become an attorney at the world's largest law firm. In this conversation, I think you'll learn a lot, and I really enjoyed recording it with Braden. Before we get into this episode, though, I first want to talk about our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Arculus. Arculus is the next generation crypto and NFT cold storage wallet that combines one of the world's strongest security protocols with the easiest to use form factor and app. They have three-factor authentication, and you can use your PIN and the Arculus key card along with biometrics. They don't compromise your holdings by requiring a USB port, charging, or browser connections. With Arculus, you're protected from hackers and institutions freezing your access. Learn more today and buy it now at getarculus.com. You can use promo code POMP to save 15%. Getarculus.com, use promo code POMP. And remember, with Arculus, it's your keys, your crypto. This episode is brought to you by Unstoppable Domains. They've partnered with blockchain.com to create NFT domain names ending in .blockchain. It's the perfect ending to show that you're a believer in a decentralized future. The blockchain.com community can join a short waitlist to get one for free at blockchain.com/waitlist/blockchain domain. Free NFT domains provide all the benefits of premium Unstoppable Domains, including fee-free lifelong ownership. If you don't have a blockchain.com wallet, no worries. There's new free domains available to everyone. Either join the waitlist for a free blockchain.com domain or visit unstoppabledomains.com to buy your domain today, starting as low as $5. Unstoppabledomains.com. This episode is brought to you by Valor, which represents what's next in the digital economy. They provide simplified, trusted access in crypto, decentralized finance, and Web3 investment opportunities. Institutions and investors can gain diversified, secure, compliant, and easily tradable access to a diversified set of industry-leading equity products and protocols, all through a single stock purchase on a regulated exchange. They currently are listed in the U.S. under the DEFTF stock ticker and on the Canadian NEO Exchange under DEFI. For more information or to subscribe to receive company updates and financial information, visit their website at valor.com. That's V-A-L-O-U-R.com.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I've got Braden here with me. I thought a great place to start is you are a lawyer, so you can say you can give legal advice to clients. What's going on with crypto regulation? Like, it feels the entire industry continues to ask, we want regulatory clarity. We want regulatory clarity. How do you underwrite where we are right now on that?
Yeah, well, I have to begin by saying I'm not giving legal advice today and that my views are my own and not necessarily the views of my firm. But with that, we're in an interesting spot. I think if you look at 2017, what happened with the price of Bitcoin blowing up, a lot of folks had to start paying attention to this industry. Mm-hmm. I, at that time, started a task force that was trying to educate regulators. I was at FINRA at the time as an extern in law school, and I was engaged in a bunch of different investigations of ICOs, right, that were coming in through the JOBS Act, right, crowdfunding regulation. Right, that we're raising money on Republic and whatnot. And if you look at where we started to where we are now, we have made progress, but a lot of the regulation that's coming down is through enforcement, right? And as a market participant, you don't love that because it's hard to have any certainty about what you can do and what you can't do because all that you can really do is see what the SEC is deciding to enforcement actions. And so I think it's difficult, but if you're somebody involved in the space right now, what you really need to be thinking about is how do I deliver value to the marketplace, right? There's a lot of different coins, a lot of tokens, a lot of projects, but I think you really need to think about how do I create a use case, right, through this project, implement the technology, right? But focus on this idea of value and creating value for for the community.
How do law firms think about operating in environments where maybe it's not so clear exactly what the rules are, right? And what I mean by that is, like, obviously law firms aren't going to talk to clients or even internally and say, like, hey, we should go break the rules. But if you don't know what the rules are, what's, like, the framework? What's the conversation inside of various large law firms that are trying to figure this out, I think, alongside market participants, alongside regulators? Like there's a lot of different types of groups, but most people don't understand how the law firms themselves think about kind of where we are in the market.
I think we start with published guidance from the regulators. And at this point, there are a lot of statements that have been made by the SEC, by different governmental groups about, hey, we think about these sorts of products and these sorts of tokens or these sorts of issues in this way. And we start to put together a plan to help that startup or that project find out where the lines are, right? Because it's never going to be perfect, right now, depending on what you're trying to do. But I think starting out with, hey, listen, you can't raise money to build a product that doesn't exist using investor funds and then promise a bonus of tokens, right? We learned that the hard way over and over and over again. That's not going to work. So I think building your project with, you know, if you can self-fund it, if you can get accredited investors to be involved and be part of the project and deliver something that has value and then sell that thing that has value, you want to be in that commodity space unless you want to go the securities route. And I think, you know, if you're willing, if you have the funds to be able to just say, listen, this might be a security, let's just go that route and try to register, you know, you may be able to avoid some of those issues, but most startups,
Is it a money thing? Is that why most of these projects, technologies, teams, whatever, are not just saying, hey, let me register as a security?
So there's a couple of things. Money as a startup, as a new company, is going to be a lot of what you're thinking about because it's not cheap to hire these big firms. And the issues are thorny, right? And then you think about disclosure and the burden of being a registered security with the SEC and what that means in terms of ongoing governance. It's showing your work every day, right? Everything that you're doing, everything that you're saying, you're always being asked questions. You ought to make sure everything you're saying is accurate. It's difficult to do. Every public company has issues doing it with a ton of money. So you think about a startup trying to compete and play that game, it gets pretty hairy pretty quickly. But that being said, you can do it, right? And we have seen projects that have done that.
Yeah. And what is the current thought process around something like Bitcoin? Like, it feels like the SEC, the CFTC, and most market participants all agree that this is not a security. Is that generally the kind of conclusion at the moment?
So that's the other thing that's going on. So you also have this jurisdictional issue, right, between the CFTC, which from the very beginning was like, listen, crypto, they're commodities, unless they're not, right? And they fall within our jurisdiction, and it's really plain and simple. And then you have the SEC that's saying, yeah, sometimes, but we really need to be heavily involved and evaluate each one and make sure that there aren't factors. Because the Howey test, right, it's looking at investment of money, right, with this reliance on others, right, to actually build the company and generate profits, and you're expecting to profit, right, as a result of those efforts. And when you see these promoters, a lot of times with a lot of these coins, it gets pretty tricky. With Bitcoin, there's not this one person who is the godfather, the promoter, who's saying, use Bitcoin, buy Bitcoin, and we're all saying, hey, we're relying on you. We're relying on you to build the infrastructure, to make sure that there's continuous value in Bitcoin, to make sure that you're making partnerships with big companies to accept Bitcoin. With a lot of these smaller tokens, if you look at Shiba Inu, you look at Doge, you look at Musk Gold, you look at a lot of these things, the tricky aspect is that you're really are relying on the founders to go and build the infrastructure and create the value for the coin as the community. And if you're the SEC, it's a little bit tricky because you're saying, well, a lot of people did buy this token mm-hmm. in order to make money. They wanted
it's a security.
Yeah.
What percentage of the long tail of assets do you think are securities versus not? And again, there's no right answer. It's just like right. kind of given what we know now, do you think it's like over under 50%?
I think definitely under.
Under 50%.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Yeah. I would think that you would have thought over. So why under?
So I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that just because remember, the Howey test, these are all factors, mm-hmm. right? If just because you have a promoter that's really active mm-hmm. and you have this, you know, this expectation of profit, that doesn't mean it's an investment contract necessarily.
Okay.
Right? You have to weigh all the different factors. So I would say under because it's really difficult to say as an investor or somebody who buys Doge or buys, you know, one of these meme coins that there is a reasonable expectation of profit and that is the same kind of investment contract that you mm-hmm. enter into when you buy stock mm-hmm. in GME or whatever.
So right? in some way, like, it's almost like it's such a joke and everyone's in on the joke that, like, it can't be taken seriously?
It's for fun. It's a community my personal opinion, this is just my view, is it's about this community. And when you buy a token, you buy Doge, you buy Musk Gold, mm-hmm. you're joining this community. You're mm-hmm. saying, I'm now part of this community mm-hmm. and we're all kind of in it together. Mm-hmm. Where you run into issues is where you have one or two people or five people mm-hmm. or just the advisors mm-hmm. who make all the decisions, mm-hmm. right? They do everything. And mm-hmm. everyone's relying on them to do it. That's mm-hmm. where you get into issues. Where you've seen it happen successfully is where the whole community, and that's where it's mm-hmm. powerful. That's mm-hmm. the power of crypto. Mm-hmm. That's where everybody sits there and scratches their head and says, wow, right? Because when you have 100,000 people in a community, mm-hmm. 200,000 people in a community, mm-hmm. all thinking about how do I create value for this token, mm-hmm. that's where it gets special. And mm-hmm. Can't be a security at all because mm-hmm. everybody's engaged. They're all part of the process. They're mm-hmm. not relying on a promoter to do everything.
Got it. And so, like, when we see this playing out, does it come into is it a factor if the team that created it ends up making money? Like, I understand the expectation from the audience or the investor or the person buying the token or whatever, and they're relying on the team. But what happens if the team makes money? Does that have any contribution at all?
I think that's where, again, right? That's where if you're a regulator and you're seeing that most people got the rug pulled.
Yeah.
Right? And you see that the founders knew the right moment to mm-hmm. sell, right? And they made a buck and nobody else did. That becomes troublesome because, again, it makes it look like you really are in control because mm-hmm. you knew when to sell. Mm-hmm. You're an insider and you sold mm-hmm. and the other folks in the community, they look like investors. They mm-hmm. look like people who weren't fully in. They weren't fully insiders. Mm-hmm. That's why I think DAOs are really interesting. Mm-hmm. And the more decentralized that you can build these projects, even if they're not technologically decentralized, mm-hmm. even just literally having a voting system, just old school, mm-hmm. old school, just putting questions out to the community. Mm-hmm. Hey guys, what do you think? Should we do this or this or this?
So this is fascinating because I think I don't want to speak for or overgeneralize all of the critiques, but I think one of the critiques that has a lot of nuance to it, so it's really hard to like talk on Twitter and stuff like that, is that there's a separation between like, is this valuable? Is this interesting? Is this a way to interact with your customers, your partners, your community, whatever kind of group they fall into with this, I'm going to call it like democratic type approach, right? So posing a question, getting answers, then using that information to go change what you're doing. I think that like, I don't hear a lot of people being like, oh, that's dumb, right? Like big companies run surveys and that's a thing that has been around for a while. One of the critiques I hear that's like a nuanced, interesting one is like, okay, but there's a difference between saying, hey, we're going to work with the community or work with the DAO or survey or do whatever, and then saying it's like decentralized. And like you hit on this idea of like technically decentralized versus like a new type of mechanism of communicating. And I think right now, I don't think there's a lot of malicious actors is my read, but they're all getting lumped together and the term decentralized just becomes like a marketing term. So it's like, hey, it's decentralized. And then they'll point and be like, because we like talk to the community and like we get information.
Yeah.
But will regulators actually peel those apart and say, like, decentralization is like a technology measurement? And yeah. And the reason why I separate those is, like, is there like a number? Is it like, if you have 3, then that's decentralized, or is it like 30 right. or 3,000 or, you know, 3 million? Like
right.
how do you measure that? And I don't know, yeah. maybe we just don't know the answers yet.
Well, so I think you're hitting on all the right points, right? Mm-hmm. So the regulators are very interested in the definition of decentralized and yeah. what that means. And partly the reason why is because promoters of coins that they've come across, that's what they're saying, right? That's one of the things that the regulators have had to field, right? Is, well, this is decentralized. And they're like, well, what does that mean, mm-hmm. right? Is it really decentralized? And you have different—
How do they evaluate that as of right now, or your understanding?
So I think right now, it's really technological, right?
In okay. terms of, but it's like nodes or users or something like that.
But here's the issue. So let's say it is completely technologically decentralized, mm-hmm. right? It literally, on the blockchain, you have to have a certain amount of buy-in for certain things to happen mm-hmm. on the chain. And there's no one way for any individual to circumvent that or mm-hmm. change that from happening. Mm-hmm. What about the servers that everything's being run on? Mm-hmm. Is there any maintenance that has to happen? Who's mm-hmm. in charge of that maintenance? If you're trying to get listed on an exchange, who is the individual who contacts that exchange and says, hey, we want to get listed?
Interesting.
If there is a deal, right? If there's a big deal with a company, a lot of times big companies will buy huge amounts of different tokens and give them away or mm-hmm. do different promos with them or accept those tokens after buying a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. Who are they interacting with? Are they only interacting through the exchange to buy those tokens? Or is there someone, even if they're just a whale, right? Mm-hmm. That may be enough, right? So you have to think about that kind of stuff. If you're just a whale, you just own tons, mm-hmm. but you own so much that you're able to actually
your de facto customer service, your de facto BD, right?
Is it decentralized in that situation?
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff, I think, is just, it's tricky. And that's why I think you have to start, if you love crypto and you love blockchain, mm-hmm. you love Bitcoin, mm-hmm. and you want to develop a company in this space, you have to think about what is a real world problem? What's mm-hmm. a real world problem? You got to come back to square one. Mm-hmm. And you talk a lot about this, about mm-hmm. building shit that people want, yeah. right? You have to do that. You got to mm-hmm. start with, it's not going to do it anymore. It's not mm-hmm. 2017. Mm-hmm. You can't just throw together a meme coin mm-hmm. and think it's going to go to the moon. Mm-hmm. That's, investors deserve more. The mm-hmm. community deserves more. Mm-hmm. So whether you're going to go the security route or whether you think you've built a commodity, mm-hmm. Bitcoin is a commodity. Mm-hmm. It's proven, right? It's not a meme coin, mm-hmm. right? It really does have value because there's a tremendous infrastructure by being the first major coin out,
yeah.
right? And so I think folks need to stop trying to be the next Bitcoin, and they need to start thinking about, how can I leverage blockchain mm-hmm. to build something that people fucking want?
Yeah. What's fascinating about it is there's this weird, maybe dichotomy is the right word, where a blockchain's entire purpose is to get to decentralization because that leads to security.
Yeah.
There are very few things that in the legacy world have decentralization or this kind of robust, resilient security
right.
that also are efficient. Almost nothing,
right?
right? It's like Amazon is super centralized, hierarchical structure.
Right.
Like they stamp out all the bureaucracy, all of the kind of wastefulness, and they just go for efficiency. How do we get something from point A to point B as fast as possible, as cheap as possible, and like deliver value to the customer?
Right.
And what's fascinating about that is, could there be a decentralized Amazon? Like, I'm unconvinced of that specific business because the whole business is around efficiency, and the trade-off between like high security versus high efficiency seems to be like a big question people have to make a decision on.
Yeah.
Bitcoin, on the other hand, is super decentralized, super secure, but plenty of critics would argue, oh, it has a 10-minute block time, or the fees did spike in past bull markets before the invention and kind of operationalization of Lightning Network and things mm-hmm. like that. And so what you saw was like layer one, super secure, and if you want to be scalable, if you want to be efficient, you have to then move to these kind of upper layers.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of my big questions, I don't know what the answer to this is, but one of my big questions is, what is the real world use case where there's a solution to a real problem like you're describing, but can still be decentralized and solve the efficiency problem? And it's like, that's asking a lot, of people to do. And so it's fascinating because it ultimately gets at the heart of what the regulators, I think, are asking themselves, which is like decentralization is important, but there's a lot of use cases where actually probably it shouldn't be decentralized, which then leads to this whole idea of like, well, then I think people may have to register them as securities. And like, how do you do that? Right.
Well, there will almost, so that's why it becomes interesting to think about what does decentralization mean?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because in most cases, there will always be stakeholders. There mm-hmm. will always be people who, regardless of the general landscape,
mm-hmm.
are more well positioned to benefit from the project, service, company,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is, than others,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think when you talk about Bitcoin and the criticism of efficiencies in Bitcoin relative to other things, I don't think that that criticism is fair.
Mm-hmm.
I think realistically, there's always a fee to use any service. You mm-hmm. look at PayPal, they charge fees, mm-hmm. right? And so Bitcoin is mostly free,
mm-hmm.
but you may have to pay fees and transaction costs to actually keep the train moving.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is just fair. It makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's almost inconceivable that you would have a product or a service
mm-hmm.
or a technology that was completely frictionless,
mm-hmm.
right? That didn't have any fees associated with
yep.
it. Because things that have value,
mm-hmm.
there's something there.
Yeah.
Right.
In your entire time in what I'll call kind of the legal regulatory part of this industry, whether it was FINRA, law firms, the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
was there ever a time where like somebody did something and you all just looked around the room and started laughing? Like, that can't be real. Because sometimes I see things, right? And like, I'm not looking at it through the legal or the regulatory lens, but I see stuff and I'm like, that literally cannot be real. Like, somebody has to be joking. Somebody has to, because there's just crazy shit that happens. And when there's like less rules, there's more kind of a wild, wild west aspect to it. Is that also happening inside like law firms and the regulatory bodies where like sometimes they're just shocked at like what somebody attempts to do?
I would say that the kinds of clients that approach big law firms mm-hmm. typically are a little bit more mature. They have a little bit more money.
Mm-hmm.
They're thinking about things in a different way,
mm-hmm.
right? Things are obviously moving at rapid pace,
mm-hmm.
and something that seemed insane to do, right, in mm-hmm. 2015, now you might be looking at it a little bit differently because mm-hmm. there might be new guidance in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's so many different projects mm-hmm. out there. There's literally thousands and thousands. I thought for sure we were at the end in 2018. I was like, wow, how many more projects can there be?
Yep.
How many more coins can there possibly be? And
mm-hmm.
and of course, it's just continued to increase. And of course, there can't be value in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are, I mean, is it ridiculous to just put a coin out there on the Ethereum blockchain,
mm-hmm.
you know, an ETH coin and just throw it out there and tell people to buy it?
Mm-hmm.
I think so, right? Mm-hmm. I think you need to think about how you're generating value for mm-hmm. that end user, the person mm-hmm. who is adding that commodity. It's not always a securities thing. It's
mm-hmm.
just about doing the right thing and building something that's going to last,
mm-hmm.
right? If your goal is to send something to the moon for 5 minutes and pull the rug,
mm-hmm.
and maybe it'll work if you build it, if you send a bunch of memes out there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to build something that's going to last,
mm-hmm.
something like Bitcoin, something mm-hmm. like gold,
mm-hmm.
you have to start with infrastructure and start with value.
Yeah, it's fascinating. What's your background? Like you have a pretty interesting story. And I think that most people who see your story would be like, how do you go from where you start to inside of a major law firm and kind of on the cutting edge of these technologies and these markets and all of that? Like walk me through how that happened.
Yeah. So I grew up in Okotoks, Alberta. It's mm-hmm. a small town outside of Calgary in mm-hmm. Western Canada, about 20,000 people in my town at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Not a very diverse place.
Mm-hmm.
Only one of like three black families
mm-hmm.
in the town. And so I dealt with a lot of racism, a mm-hmm. lot of bias. But I think my perspective on these issues is colored a little bit differently because
mm-hmm.
I came from that environment.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in an abusive household.
Mm-hmm.
Things weren't great at home.
Mm-hmm.
I was homeless for periods of time,
mm-hmm.
Lived on people's couches, right? But I think what that created was a different sense of how I evaluate opportunity, right? I look at opportunity and I think of it like a damp rag, right? And opportunity and value is like is moisture. It's water. And we all grow up and we're given a rag and we can get more and we may be able to add moisture and add value to our rag, but we don't necessarily control how we start. And I started out growing up homeless, growing up in an abusive household. I was homeless at 12 years old, bouncing around, living on different friends' couches. There wasn't a ton of moisture in my rag. But when things started to kind of shift for me, I read a book called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And like that book saved my life, right? So for me, I read that book at 12 years old. And I started to think about my life and my damp rag in a different way. And it started with gratitude. It started with, instead of looking at everybody else, oil is big in Alberta, Canada, huge. And so I had a lot of friends who were very wealthy. It was odd to grow up how I did. We were very, very poor. I had a lot of challenges, but many of my close friends and teammates on the football team and basketball team were extremely wealthy. And so it was thrown in my face, right? In a very interesting way that I don't think happens a lot in America, because I was able to live in an area that was very wealthy, but have absolutely no money at all, and not actually have the same benefits as everybody else, right? And so when I started to kind of just be grateful for everything that I did have, that's when things started to really take shape for me. So I got a call from a coach in North Carolina. This is where things started to kind of shift for me. His name's Ro Russell, and he was responsible for sending a bunch of guys to the NBA. Tristan Thompson, Corey Joseph, right? Helped identify Andrew Wiggins. And me and Andrew Wiggins and a bunch of other folks got the call to join this school in North Carolina.
What was it called?
It was called Christian Faith Center Academy. And it was, for me, as I was homeless at the time. So, like, this was, like, the best opportunity ever, right? And because I didn't have that dynamic with my parents where they were going to say, hey, we got to ask all the questions about this. Hey, I don't know if this is the right thing. That wasn't the situation for me. I didn't ask my mom. I told my mom, right? See you later. I'm going to North Carolina. We ended up, there was a couple different apartments and there were 16 of us jam-packed into these little apartments where it's kind of all on top of each other. Living situation.
How many kids were at school?
The basketball team was like part of a separate portion of the school. Maybe there was a couple hundred people total in the school. But the basketball program had like its own curriculum.
What was it? I think Tracy McGrady went to Mount Zion.
Right? We played against that school. We're in that league.
So Tracy McGrady, I think there's 12 people on the team and there was 12 kids at the school at the time. And like they got in some trouble later.
Similar deal.
Yeah. Okay.
Similar deal. Because our school was it was technically separate from the rest of the school. But like big picture, is Ro Russell a bad guy? No, he's not a bad guy, right? He's trying to hustle and squeeze his rag like everybody else is, trying to give opportunities to kids. He didn't cross all of his T's and dot all of his I's.
Did he get in trouble?
In terms of how much trouble he actually got in, I'm not sure. Certainly he has remorse about how it went down. I ended up becoming an All-American. I ended up playing on the Canadian national team. I ended up getting scouted to play for, you know, better prep schools that were established and different things. There did end up being an issue with my transcripts from that school. So I had to redo that year, right? It's all water under the bridge now, but part of it comes down to that issue of resilience and how you internalize things that happen to you. I didn't ever see myself as a victim at that school, even though we were literally, we got in fist fights over food, right? Because they would drop over. Think about it. You have 16 boys between the ages of like 13 and 19, you drop off groceries once a week. What do you think kids are doing? They're storing it under their mattress. They're taking it to their room, right? The biggest kids are like, nah, man, that's all mine. And you got to like, but that's how I had to come up. Right. And so when I think about opportunity, I see what's there when a lot of folks don't see what's there. So I saw that opportunity as my chance to get to a better school. So I was like, the basketball piece of this is real deal. We got Andrew Wiggins here. We're playing. We played Mount Zion. I dropped a 30 piece on Mount Zion. Right. There's coaches in the stands.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going anywhere.
Yep.
I was like, I got this. I can fight for food.
Yep.
I can sleep in a room with four boys. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to leverage this.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And the next year I went to Wilbraham and Munson, which is a really, really good private school outside of Boston. And from there, right, got the scholarship to Kansas. And then, but you always have to be prepared for a punch in the mouth. So I signed with Kansas, which was the number one school in the country at that time. Dream come true for me. At that point, a total crazy story from homelessness to where I was in North Carolina. Now I've signed with the number one school in the country. Everyone thought I was going to the league right away. And I spend the whole summer there. And what happens? NCAA rules me a partial qualifier.
Really?
Because they don't accept the transcripts from that school in North Carolina.
Really?
Right? And so it's a big punch in the mouth. It's like, literally, I'm at the precipice of everything I've ever wanted. Of course I got to make it to the league now. Look at who I'm around. I'm training with Thomas Robinson. Ben McLemore was in my class. All leaguers, everybody, right? And so from there, it's like, well, what do I do? And I had learned, though, through my life up until that point, this isn't a time to internalize my victimhood. This isn't a time for that. What do I do? They were trying to get me to go to a JUCO because that's the easiest way to get people qualified. Send
this
kid
JUCO,
to a JUCO,
come back.
Get them back. And I was like, as a, in terms of academically, I was a 1450 SAT. So I was like, I'm a better student than that. There's got to be a better way, right? All due respect to going the JUCO route, there's got to be a better way. And so I decided to go to Fresno State. Right. I got going there. The deal, the goal was to do like a one and done, right? Two and done, what have you. Literally a month before my first season where I was going to be eligible to play, I break my neck in a car accident.
Holy shit. Yeah.
C5, C6, totally destroyed. They have to airlift me out of there in a helicopter. I had a 0.06% chance of making a full recovery.
Wow.
The surgeon, I actually had the same neck surgeon as Peyton Manning, Gene Carrigy. He said, if I would have taken my jacket off, if I would have tried to take my shirt off, adjusted anything, I would be a quadriplegic. Right? Because any little move, and you learn this, if you play football growing up, you learn, if you if your neck hurts, don't move. You lay back straight, and it doesn't matter what anybody tells you to do. You don't move. But I spent almost a month in the hospital, lost almost 40% of my body weight, had to learn how to walk again, right? And this is, again, it's a punch in the mouth. As soon as I clawed my way back to the mat again, and I'm going to have a chance to play, it's at Fresno State, it's not Kansas, but it's okay. I'm going to leverage this opportunity. It doesn't matter. Paul George just came out of here. I got this, right? But and Tyler Johnson came out of there too and did great, former teammate. But it's all about mentality. At that point, I've now broken my neck, and you already know what's going on in the coaches' minds. They're like, okay, I don't know if, the, like, 0.6%, it's tough. We love you, buddy, but I think we got to start recruiting, you know? And so, of course, they're thinking, I don't know what's going to happen with this guy, and I don't know what's going to happen to me. It's like the Friday Night Lights, Boobie Miles. He's like, hey, Doc, am I going to be able to play again? It's like, I don't know, man. Right. And he told me that. And I had that moment where you're seeing in the doctor's eyes, he's not pulling your leg. He really doesn't know. And from there, I came up with a new game plan. Right. It's again, okay, so how do I leverage this opportunity? How do I leverage the opportunity? It's just the mindset of being a gravely injured, may not make a full recovery, but still on full academic scholarship as of right now. How do I take advantage of that? And literally the only answer is, okay, right now you're still being paid. You don't get paid in dollars as a student athlete, but you get paid in education. So my goal at that moment was I want to become the highest paid college athlete of all time, right? In education. And how do you do that? Max out credits. I took 32 credits that next semester. The next semester, another plus 30. The next semester, almost 30, 27, right? I had to write letters to the president of the university to get permission because 15 is usually the max, right? But that it's dollars. Every credit was dollars. So I graduated early. And then from there, again, if your goal is to become the highest paid basketball player in college of all time, I always wanted to go to law school. let's make basketball pay for it. I graduated early. I had 2 years of eligibility left, right? So I'm just, I'm scheming because so many people get taken advantage of by the amateur system in the NCAA. I was the perfect candidate for somebody to get taken advantage of. Somebody who was supposed to be this great player, who gets in a terrible car accident. And now what am I going to do? Go back to Canada and sleep on my mom's couch until I'm homeless again? Right? It's like, no, I don't have that opportunity to be average or to internalize this as, wow, I'm a victim again. Can you believe it? Everything bad keeps happening to me. Everything bad did keep happening to me, but it didn't matter. Right? And so from that moment, it's again, I remember talking to my coaches at Fresno. I was like, hey, I want to graduate early. I want to be the first person to ever play NCAA ball while in law school full time.
That's awesome.
And the dude, I mean, not going to name names, he laughed in my face.
Yeah.
And it, like, I have to share that because it was one of the most pivotal moments for me again. When someone laughs in your face, man, and like truly from a position of experience, thinks it's funny what you think that you can achieve.
Yeah, they're laughing at your ambition.
Dude, it's testing.
Yeah.
And it absolutely is the measure of a human being, what you do next and how you respond. And I was like, okay, this is going to be harder than I thought, right? Because if he thinks that it's that funny, I have to think about objectively and pragmatically what that means. It means that it really is going to be hard because no one's ever done it. Why is that? So I had to put more time and effort into my game plan to make that happen. And how I did that was I started to think about what is the value? Why would anybody let someone do that? Right? Because there's a lot of downsides. If you let someone do something that's never been done, if you fail, you look stupid. You look silly. The whole university, the athletic program, you're going to say, why'd you let this kid do this? Of course it's not going to work. That's why it's never been done. Because whatever you're going to say, athletes aren't cut out for law school or whatever you're going to say, or it's too much of a burden to play 8 hours of basketball and be a full-time law student. It was ridiculous. It was truly an absurd journey to go through. But I pitched it as, well, the value in doing it is that what if I succeed? What if I do succeed? And maybe I'm the guy to do it. Right? And I had to just kind of pitch them on, listen, Seton Hall, I've been through a lot and I've overcome a lot and I don't lose. I may fail in the mean, like failure isn't going to stop me. Right? If I get punched in the mouth, I'm going to keep going and I'm not going to make you look bad. And I promise you, I'm the guy who's not going to make you look bad. And I'm going to leverage all of the possible value out of this law school education and being a student athlete that I possibly can to make the university look good and to make myself look good and to make the basketball team look good and the law school look good. Right. And you just got to take this chance on me. I'm the guy. And luckily they saw in me, they were like, listen, I don't want to get in your way. Right. You may be right. You may be wrong, but you seem really sure about this. I'm not going to get in your way. I hope it works out. And I think a lot of times in life, people are afraid to put their greatest ambitions out there. There's a lot of people who say, you know, what you do in the dark shines in the light and stuff like that. I totally disagree with that. The universe works in a way that when you put out there your greatest hopes and dreams and desires, and you work as hard as you possibly can, and you tell others, all volunteer information, here's all the things I'm doing to make this happen. I'm not asking you for anything, but are you going to get in my way? Are you going to try to stop me? Right? And that mentality, I think, is something that's missing a lot from the narrative around a lot of different issues that have to do with resilience, particularly Black resilience and Black empowerment. That's not something that's been focused on, right? So if you think about Black Lives Matter, it's polarizing. There's a lot of people who have a lot of different things to say on both sides, and it's divided a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's been important in terms of awareness, right? I think that's really one of the only things that it's done is driven awareness, and there's just a flip side to that coin. But without undermining what Black Lives Matter has done, let's think about what it hasn't done. 64% of Black Americans in this country say that Black Lives Matter and the increased attention on racism over the last couple of years hasn't led to any meaningful change in their life, which is pretty profound.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy stat.
It's like and I think it's very surprising when I, especially with folks that I speak to, both sympathizers and people who have, you know, their own opinions about it. It's that's surprising. And the reason why is celebrating victimhood creates more learned helplessness, right? So when you celebrate and focus your attention on victimhood and pain and trauma, and you think about millions and millions of Black Americans and white Americans for 3 years being locked in their house, watching videos of Black people getting killed every day, that doesn't build up a strong narrative and a strong idea about Black people as strong, powerful, capable, skilled, excellent people in our society, right? That doesn't necessarily inure itself to the right approach in terms of hiring, right? If you're hiring a Black person because you feel sympathy or because you feel guilty, that's not why you should be hiring Black people or anybody in a diverse group, right? If you think about the feminist movement and what made it really, really successful was it was the celebration of excellent women. It was excellent, excellent women who were geniuses, who were really great at what they did. And the whole world was like, wow, I need to hire a woman right now. Right? If you're head of a company, you're
it's basically pattern recognition. Like it's the creation of a new pattern to recognize, right? This episode is brought to you by Amber Data. If you're a financial institution entering the digital asset class, you'll need access to granular on-chain and market data from multiple venues to power research, trading, risk management, and compliance. Amber Data delivers comprehensive data and insights into blockchain networks, crypto markets, and decentralized finance, empowering financial institutions to apply traditional finance methods to digital assets. Amber Data eliminates the infrastructure setup, integrated challenges, and maintenance headaches to access digital assets data, reducing cost and time to market to enter the digital asset class. Learn more and download their digital asset data guide at www.amberdata.io/pomp. Again, that's amberdata.io/pomp. Go check them out today. This episode is brought to you by FTX US. They're the safe, regulated way to buy and sell Bitcoin and other digital assets. Trade crypto with up to 85% lower fees than the top competitors. There are no fixed minimums, no ACH transaction fees, and no withdrawal fees. Download the FTX app today and use referral code POMP to earn free crypto on every trade over $10. The more you trade, the more you earn. Go download the FTX app today and use referral code POMP. This episode is brought to you by LMAX Digital, the number one institutional crypto exchange. They offer clients the deepest pool of liquidity, and they have a 100% uptime track record through all the volatility spikes. LMAX Group's liquidity relationships and ultra-low latency technology means that LMAX Digital is the market-leading solution for institutions across crypto trading and custodial services. LMAX Digital, secure, liquid, and trusted. Go learn more at lmaxdigital.com/pomp. Again, that's lmaxdigital.com/pomp. It's fascinating because I think a friend of mine said this to me one time. They're immigrant, and we were talking about, I think a report had come out, and it was all about percentage of employees that were born in the United States versus immigrants and all stuff. And he said it to me in just like such a blunt way. He's like, I don't want to be hired because I'm an immigrant. I want to be hired because I did a great job. And I just was like, I've never heard anyone just explicitly say it in that manner. And his point was, I don't want to say where he's from because it'll give it away, but like, he was like, where I'm from, no one expects them to be able to go from there to a highly successful job in tech. If I do it, maybe actually people will then say, maybe I should go find another person who's an immigrant from that place, right? And you create this new pattern to recognize. And in some way, like, there's a lot of patterns. Like, one of the things that it is like very weird, is like the autistic pattern of somehow in tech, people are like, oh, if there's like an element of like being on the autism spectrum, there's value that is assigned to that because of past patterns that they have identified.
That's interesting.
And so you like start to see this. And I think what you're describing is less like the sympathy component and more of like, it takes somebody to be the first data point in the trend that then creates the pattern, which then people use to recognize over and over and over again, right?
And to enrich and grow yourself.
Yeah.
Right. So I think about
the pioneer definitely benefits from being the pioneer.
Absolutely. Yes. And everybody watching the pioneer
yes.
who came from that same environment.
Yeah.
I grew up not ever. I never saw a black doctor, a black mm-hmm. lawyer, black mm-hmm. investor, black entrepreneur. Just didn't mm-hmm. see it. Mm-hmm. Right. And that does a lot. That mm-hmm. does a lot to you in terms of what you think you can achieve. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks growing up in black communities see black athletes, they see mm-hmm. black entertainers. Mm-hmm. And there's no question, if you ask folks in those communities, do you think you could become a rapper or an athlete? Most people say, yeah, I could do that, mm-hmm. right? And but if you ask them, could you become a billion-dollar investor? Mm-hmm. Do you think you could create a startup that 10Xs mm-hmm. and gets listed on the New York Stock Exchange, or do you think you could become an attorney at the biggest law firm in the world? Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like, oh, I don't know, right? Mm-hmm. And some of my teammates and some folks along the way have told me about my aspirations that that's white shit. Mm-hmm. That's white, mm-hmm. right? Me focusing on school, me wanting to become an attorney, mm-hmm. that's white. I'm trying to succeed in the white world. Mm-hmm. And that's bullshit, mm-hmm. right? Just plain and simple, that's bullshit. But that kind of narrative gets... That narrative is created from the celebration of victimhood mm-hmm. and the focus on it without putting the focus on folks who actually are succeeding. Because yeah. there's actually a lot of black entrepreneurs and a lot of black achievers and lawyers mm-hmm. and doctors.
I'm fascinated with Jay-Z, mainly because obviously he comes from where he comes from. His kind of early career is very well documented.
Yeah.
Now I think is very well respected in the business community and the investment community. People realize like, hey, this guy like understands what he's doing and they respect him for the mm-hmm. skills and experiences that he's acquired. But then he still will turn around and he'll use the music to basically talk about it.
Yeah.
And in the new DJ Khaled song, he basically talks about like, he says something like, there's 3 billionaires that come from kind of his group of friends, him, Kanye, Rihanna. And then he's like, right. Oh, by the way, LeBron is also a rock boy, right? So that's right. 4. Right. Then he explains something. He's like from corner boys. We're corner boys with corner offices. And this idea of like, he still has a very similar mentality of just like, get up every day, work your ass off, like do the things necessary to be successful. But he's been able to transcend into like a different world. And I think that he probably more so than anyone else I've seen in music or entertainers or anything, maybe you could put like a Michael Jordan, LeBron up there as well. But mm-hmm. like Jay-Z specifically has been able to do it and then talk about it in a way that I think resonates with tons and tons of young people. And it's pretty powerful.
He's a perfect example,
yeah.
right, of black resilience, of mm-hmm. black excellence. It's and again, it starts with whatever you have.
Mm-hmm.
For Jay-Z, it started with music.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very talented musician and artist, and he leveraged that to create an empire
mm-hmm.
and to become a businessman,
mm-hmm.
right? That is really, really important because mm-hmm. for me, all that I had, I was homeless. Mm-hmm. I literally needed basketball. Mm-hmm. It's okay. I needed
it. Take it out.
It was my ticket yes. to get an education. I yes. would never have gotten an education mm-hmm. without basketball, but mm-hmm. that doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter now. Mm-hmm. Right, I'm an attorney at the biggest firm in the world. Doesn't matter that the only reason that I got
no one asks you that when you walk in the room,
right? It doesn't matter, right? Yeah. You're in the same room as everybody else, and mm-hmm. Jay-Z is a perfect example of
yeah.
that.
Tell me about the book. You wrote a book on yeah. a lot of these topics, which I think is fascinating because it's not just like you understand them and kind of live your own life that way. You also took the time to write them down so that other people could read them as well.
Yeah, I thought about how can I best leverage my story and what mm-hmm. I've been through to help other people and help mm-hmm. as many other people as possible. And mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of stories from my background and my experiences that have to do with racism and mm-hmm. overcoming bias.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have to do with other things too. But Black resilience is really about celebrating and focusing on how Black people in troubled environments, in against all odds, have become successful anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about saying that racism doesn't exist mm-hmm. and that it's not a problem. It's about focusing the narrative on what we can control,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think about when I break it down in terms of what I've done and what many other, black successful people have done
mm-hmm.
is they've taken inventory of the things that they can control,
mm-hmm.
right? Every one of those times that I told you earlier in the podcast that I got punched in the mouth,
mm-hmm.
I took inventory of, okay, this happened. I can feel sorry for myself, mm-hmm. or I can start taking inventory of the things that I can actually control or mm-hmm. influence.
Yep.
And putting together a plan of attack to seize every single one of those. Mm-hmm. And I think that message needs to be relayed to more people. Mm-hmm. There's too many Black Americans in this country who have seen nothing but a narrative of white people preaching at white people, mm-hmm. Black people preaching at white people. If you look at most books about race and Blackness, mm-hmm. they're written to a white audience. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Leave white people alone for a minute, mm-hmm. right? White people need to have their own conversations. Mm-hmm. Black people need to have their own conversations. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that white and Black people are having conversations, let's not have every focus conversation be on the focus of racism mm-hmm. and making the other person feel guilty. Mm-hmm. That's not how you're going to build a bridge. Mm-hmm. That's not how you're going to build one community. Mm-hmm. Racism is an issue. How do we solve that issue? Because mm-hmm. for 30 years, all we've done is preach at white people to tell them that they're racist, and it's not working. So even if you thought that that might work, it's not working. We have the data. It's not working. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that I was putting out a message mm-hmm. that just takes a different approach, mm-hmm. right? It's not that – I'm not going to say that it hasn't solved anything, what we've done over the last mm-hmm. 30 years, but it's certainly not carrying us over the goal line. Mm-hmm. And – to me, I think focusing on the Black empowerment and a huddle, mm-hmm. right? I think about the book as really a huddle. It's a Black huddle where anybody can pull up a chair. Mm-hmm. Black, white, doesn't matter. Pull up a chair, right? But this is a Black conversation. I'm talking to Black people the whole time, mm-hmm. right? And we're talking about the issues that are facing us in our communities mm-hmm. and the challenges and the obstacles that we're going to have to overcome mm-hmm. and how you might be able to go about overcoming those things mm-hmm. and be grateful for the opportunities that you do have mm-hmm. and how you might be able to leverage your career as a musician to turn that into something else, leverage your career as an athlete to turn that into something else. Mm-hmm. But bias is nothing but somebody else not understanding who you are. Mm-hmm. They just don't get it. They're not from that position. As somebody who's involved in Bitcoin and crypto, mm-hmm. you know there's a ton of people who are biased against Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. They don't know really anything about it, mm-hmm. right? Except for a bunch of propaganda that they've heard. And so you say, oh yeah, I'm Anthony Pompliano. I'm a Bitcoin guy, right? There's a lot of things that run through their mind about what that means. Mm-hmm. A lot of those things completely inaccurate because mm-hmm. they're ignorant, right? Yeah. They don't actually understand it.
Education is the great equalizer.
Right. Yeah. And so the question, right, for you would be, well, how can I make sure that I build a bridge to more people mm-hmm. so that they're not just writing me off, so that I can actually add value to mm-hmm. their lives and educate them? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be to say to every person, you're ignorant, you're biased, mm-hmm. you're a jerk? Mm-hmm. Probably won't work, mm-hmm. right? And so similarly, if somebody is biased and maybe a little racist, whether mm-hmm. they know it or not, is the best way to build value for myself and my brand and what I'm trying to accomplish, mm-hmm. to say, you're racist, you suck, you're a jerk? Probably not. Mm-hmm. It's about tact, right? Mm-hmm. It's about building a bridge, mm-hmm. trying to help that person understand who it is that you are, mm-hmm. right? With my professors in college and in law school, on the first day of school, I'd always give them like a little mini speech. I'd be like, listen, my name's Braden, I play basketball, but I care about this class so much. Yeah. I wanna be a lawyer. Right? I read X and Y studies that you did. Mm-hmm. I read your paper on Y. I'm super interested in Z. Mm-hmm. Make sure that they understand.
Oh, okay. He's not like the right? other basketball players.
Whatever it is yeah. that they yeah, got yeah. going on, I just assume they have something yeah, going on.
Of course.
Right? Because I'm not going to let bias mm-hmm. stop me from getting a good grade in this class. Mm-hmm. And if I have to, you know, if I have to kind of swallow my pride for a moment mm-hmm. and give you a little mini speech mm-hmm. and make the first effort to get to know you, mm-hmm. I'm going to do that because yeah. my career and my life is important.
Yeah, it's powerful. You
know? Right?
Right? Absolutely. Where can people find the book?
So it's available almost anywhere. Mm-hmm. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, right? You can find it through the Simon & Schuster website. If you just Google Black Resilience, Braden Anderson, you should be able to find it pretty easily.
And what about yourself in terms of people want to follow up with you or kind of discuss some of the ideas you've mentioned today?
Yeah, LinkedIn's probably the best way to get in
LinkedIn.
Touch with me. Yeah, a big LinkedIn guy. Uh-huh. That's how we got connected.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a great tool to connect with like-minded individuals mm-hmm. and people who are trying to build great things that are going to help people.
Awesome. And just Braden Anderson there as well.
Yep, absolutely.
Awesome. I really enjoyed today. I think that you have a unique perspective on a number of different things. Obviously, crypto regulation, but also just kind of the different points in your life. And I have often joked, but also dead serious, of like we have a mental toughness crisis in America, probably globally. Yeah. And I think the ideas that are in your book are quite powerful for people, and a lot of people would benefit from just hearing them. Right? You don't even necessarily have to embody all of them. You don't have to say yes, this is the only solution. But I do think it's quite powerful. So I suggest people go get it.
Yeah, it's about starting the discussion, right? Yeah. It's just about having, not everyone has to agree with every single thing in my book or everything mm-hmm. I've said today, mm-hmm. but I think it starts a conversation, and it's a conversation that we need to have in this country.
I love it. We'll definitely do this again, and I appreciate you coming today.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I really hope you enjoyed this one. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. And if you're looking to transition into a brand new job in the Bitcoin or crypto industry, we've got you covered. Head over to thecryptoacademy.io. My team and I have been working with the top HR teams in the industry to develop an intensive 3-week training program with over 50 live events. We teach you exactly what you need to know to break into the industry, including live interview prep and resume review. Our students have been hired at over 75 of the world's best Bitcoin and crypto companies. Go to thecryptoacademy.io to learn more. Again, that's thecryptoacademy.io. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you share it with your friends, and I'll see you all for the next episode.